So privileged to be here, be able to come together and have a community of Dhamma practitioners, have this astonishing quiet space to come and meditate and listen to Dhamma in. And this piece of land that we live on, with its trees and its rough paths, and its quiet, and its nature. It's such a such a blessing. Something that is so very, very hard to find in the world. And it's so very, very hard to find people, good people to practice with. And people who are intent on really trying to understand what it is that the Buddha taught and trying to practice that. This is something that's very, very hard to find. That's why I'm very happy that we had this request to have a look at some of the suttas in the Sutta Nipata for this study period, and especially to the suggestion that we chant some of the suttas from the Ataka Vagga. And as I mentioned, I think before, but that these are suttas that I have loved for many years, in which I memorized most of them at one point, although I didn't keep it up, so it's been a long time now since I've been able to recite them from memory. And there's something about the teachings in these verses which has like a ring of truth to it. When I say that, I'm reminded, I don't know if you remember the Colgate ad where you kind of smile with a ring of confidence and this kind of bing like a halo appears around your mouth to show how confident you are. Brushing with Colgate. But anyway, that's how I think that these suttas from the Ataka Vagga are. They have this kind of bing, this kind of ring of truth to them. And in many ways they speak to the for me is the essence and the heart of what monastic life is about and what the forest monasticism is about. Kama hi loke nahi supahaya. Because sensual pleasures are indeed not easy to abandon for the world. And we can see how true that is, can't we? How few people are really interested to let go. There are lots of people who are interested in Buddhism or who, you know, like to find some peace of mind and to do a bit of meditation and so on. There's lots of people who have that interest. There's not very many people who have that kind of real interest to let go, to renounce. And yet it's that attachment to pleasures which is one of the greatest sources of suffering. And I can see that. I'm like most of you, I go to the city quite regularly. And most of you here to have the opportunity, which you take and use very well, to have the seclusion in the monastery, which of course I also had in my first years in monastic life, very rarely going into the city and so on. And these days, of course, I'm constantly going down to Sydney and encountering these kinds of things, and you kind of see the feverishness of that search, all the kind of the shops and the people and the clothes and everything, food, always kind of searching, always looking. There's always got to be something new. And of course, the reality is that sense pleasures and sense distractions only hold your attention for such a short period of time. Even the most beautiful sight, the most wonderful taste, the most lovely sound, you can only hear it or see it or taste it for just a few seconds, and already the mind starts to get distracted, gets bored, wants to look somewhere else. That's why one of the essential qualities of sense pleasures, according to Buddhism, the Buddha said, "Kama hi citra madura manurama." That sense pleasures are varied, sweet and delightful. Virupa rupena mahanti chittam. With the deformation, with the change, with the vanishing of forms, then the mind becomes harassed and distressed. So there's always kind of minds torn, always looking for, trying to get this, trying to get that. And these Ataka Wagga teachings are always talking about contentment, about letting go of these things, emptying out. Like the boat, if you empty out the boat, make it light, then it'll swiftly travel across the ocean and reach the far shore. It's all the things that we want, that we like. We have this strange, deluded idea that having more of them will make us happy. And every time we know that it's just not the case. We know that all the evidence tells us that it's not the case. And even on a worldly level, all the surveys say that when people start to make more money and they get richer and so on, they don't get happier. And that's true even on a worldly level, how much more so for spiritual practitioners. So the Atthakavagga teachings are always reminding us, come back to that sense of mindfulness, sadasato, ever mindful. Always mindful of what you're doing. Always mindful of... But it's not when it says ever mindful. You know, one of the things about these Atthakavagga teachings is that they're very ethical and psychological. They're not so much talking about meditation methods and these kinds of things. And so when it's talking about being ever mindful, it's not talking about these kinds of, you know, specialized meditation techniques of being aware of the particular position of your body or your hand as it moves in this way or that. That's not what it means. It doesn't talk about that kind of practice in these chapters. And what it's talking about is being aware of what is your mind like, what is your motivations, what is your behavior, what kinds of things are you doing, what kinds of things are you taking delight in, what kinds of things are you attaching to. And it's always coming back to this sense of mine, a sense of attachment. And so it's always the one who is free of attachment, free of the sense of mine. So where santo himichati, this is said to be a person who's at peace. So this is not about, you know, completing some method or some course. It's not about achieving some level in meditation. It's about letting go. It's about the actual letting go. And I'm afraid I do think that sometimes, you know, this idea of very brilliant idea that Chogyam Trungpa had of spiritual materialism, and this idea that we bring these materialistic attitudes into our spiritual practice, we're wanting to get, wanting to have, wanting to achieve, you know, stages in meditation, or wanting to perfect a meditation method or something like that. And so, you know, we become focused on the externals rather than looking at the actual development, which is what is your mind like? What is it actually like to be doing this? How are you reacting? How are you responding? So this is always one of the beautiful things about these teachings, is that they just go straight to what is the essence. What are you attaching to? Where is the suffering arising? And always pointing back to the fact that it's this simplicity of life, this contentment. Whatever is okay. One of the suttas, it talks about somebody who's kind of worrying about, what am I going to eat tomorrow? Will the food be good? Where am I going to sleep? And someone who's travelling on Tudong, where am I going to sleep? Am I going to get something to eat tomorrow? And these thoughts are very difficult to dispel. That's why I said, you get rid of these, you don't care about it. I had one monk, a friend of mine, who was one of the few Western monks who actually did go on Tudong for long periods of time in Thailand. And it said it took him a long time, maybe a year or so of going for Tudong, for him to completely stop worrying about whether he was going to eat the next day. And there would always be that tiny little nagging thought, am I going to get anything? And of course every day he did. Every day he got some food. He didn't have to worry. But this is a little kind of worry. Back of the mind, little nagging thought. So the Buddha said he called these lamentable thoughts. You should dispel these lamentable thoughts. So for monastics, this is our attitude. You know, don't worry, is there going to be food on the table tomorrow? Don't take it for granted. There's no reason why there has to be food on the table every day. Maybe some days there isn't. Maybe someday the kitchen will run out and we won't have anything. So we just deal with it. We just accept it. Yeah. Do we have a place to sleep? Yeah, as long as we're staying here at Santi, and we have support, we have a community, we have the people to give us food, we have the place to give us a place to sleep, and all of these things. But, you know, that's not always going to be the case. Different periods of your life, maybe you don't have anywhere to sleep. So sometimes it's good to be in that situation, just to face up to that. Well, what am I going to do? I haven't got anywhere to sleep. Find a park, find a sheltered place. So these are the things which in these suttas is always the training that we're supposed to be undergoing as monastics. Is training every day. Whatever is on the, whatever is offered as food, or whatever is not offered, is fine. That's the training. Whatever kind of accommodation I have, whatever kuti I have, it's fine. That's the training. whatever duties or chores that I'm asked to do by the Sangha, then that's fine, I'll do them. That's the training. There's this quality of acceptance. It's not holding on to things, not this mamayatam. One of the things which these verses have emphasized, we talked about yesterday, is also the attachment not just to the physical things but also to ideas, attachment to views. And these verses strongly emphasize, you know, don't get into arguments, don't get into disputes. And as we discussed to some degree yesterday, it's an interesting dynamic to know exactly what is meant there. Is it just meaning don't argue about wrong views and speculative views, or don't discuss things at all, and so on? I think that one thing that I've noticed is that if we have this idea that if we have a strong view that we shouldn't be attached to views, right? Well, for a start, it's a little bit kind of contradictory, isn't it? So we have this view that we shouldn't have views. But my experience has shown me that if you have this kind of view, what actually happens most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, is that it's not actually a letting go of views, but it's what it actually is a refusal or an avoidance of actually engaging with views and what their implications are. And the end result of that is an even stronger attachment to them. If we're discussing views, if we're able to discuss them, then we can have some give and take about them. We can accept that there are different points of view. We can recognize that sometimes some of our assumptions may be incorrect. We can realize that actually this is a view that I formed without really considering the implications of it very carefully, and that maybe that other person has a point. And so when we're discussing our views, in one way we're constantly loosening them, we're constantly making them more flexible, more adaptable. And I think it's very important to do this. It's very important to be able to say what your views are, to explain what they are coherently, to give reasons for them. It's also important to be able to listen to what other people's views are, and to look at what their reasons for them are as well. And of course, when we look at views and why people have certain kinds of views, there's usually two components to it, isn't there? There's one component is the external component, which may be the evidence or the experience or the influences and so on which a person has from outside. But then there's also the inner component, which is one's own needs, one's own desires or attachments or whatever, which influence the way that you form views, and that influences them. Sometimes you're aware of that, sometimes of course we're not aware of that, and so we have these kind of unconscious reasons which are driving our attachment to views in one way or another. And that those unconscious forces usually become obvious when the view gets challenged in one way or another, and we have an unusually strong emotional reaction to that. This is where you can see if you have a strong unconscious tie to a view, is when it becomes challenged. Normally, it's normal if your view becomes challenged that you might have a certain degree of emotional investment in that. But if that emotional investment becomes very strong or unusually reactive, then that's a good sign that there's something unconscious involved in that view as well. Which is not to say that the view is wrong, but it's just to say that there's more to it than appears on the surface. So in that way, through seeing that also, this is also not a bad thing. It's helpful. It helps us. If we are discussing something with somebody and we have that kind of reaction, and we get very emotional about something, and you know, there's no real reason on the surface for us to get very emotional about it, that's telling us something about ourselves. So as practitioners, we should pay attention to that. Notice, oh, hang on, why is this? Why am I getting so upset? Why is this so important to me? Why am I so invested in proving the other person wrong? Why aren't I able to say, well, listen, the other person's got a different perspective, but there may be something to that. There may be a valuable perspective as well. Why is that? And so when we discuss our ideas, this is also part of that idea of being sadā sato, always mindful, is being able to see these responses, being able to reflect on them, not buying into them completely. And this is the way of a practitioner of Dhamma. So I don't think that the Atthakavaka teachings should be used as a justification of avoiding any kind of discussion about Dhamma or airing of different views and voicing of different views. On the contrary, there are plenty of other places in the suttas where the Buddha encourages us to come up with our views or ideas. The Buddha is very often asking the Sangha, like, what do you think about this? Constantly we find this happening. What do you think? What do you reckon? Inviting them to present their views. And then discussing them, giving reasons for why this view or why that view. So this is a very important part of our monastic training. It's something which you should take advantage of while you're here. It's not always going to be the case. As you go on in your monastic life, you'll find that sometimes you may stay in different communities, in different places. And in many communities you find that there's not really the opportunity to discuss things. Questioning is not invited. That you're expected to keep quiet, or else you find that the opposite. You find that once you get a bit of seniority, and that you're saying that everyone else will be too shy to question your opinions, and that they'll just accept everything that you say as if you're some kind of expert, and so you don't have that opportunity. Fortunately, that happens a lot less in the West than it does in traditional Buddhist countries. So I do find that people will question you, and that's good, it's healthy. But it's a genuine thing, it's a genuine problem. And so when monastics get senior, it's very easy to get very arrogant, because you're always surrounded by people who just agree with you all the time. And so we have to learn, this is something that we have to learn together, is how to make a culture where it's possible to question, to express different kinds of views, to discuss them and debate them when necessary, and to do that in a way that's mature and respectful, not in a way that's aggressive or personal, and respecting the fact that people have their different perspectives. And this was brought up in Melinda Panha, the introduction to it, when Nagasena speaking with King Melinda, and King Melinda asks him if he can ask him and discuss some various points of Dhamma. And Nagasena says, are we going to debate as like politicians or like scholars? And Melinda says, well, what's the difference? He says, well, if you're like politicians, when you're debating, if somebody says something you don't like, then you try to crush them or kill them or get rid of them. Whereas if you're scholars and you're debating, if you have different points of view, then you'll learn to understand each other's point of view and to try to appreciate what the reason is why someone holds a different view than you do. And so Melinda says, okay, we'll debate like scholars then. And Nagasena says, okay, let's do it. And so that's what they did. And they had this debate where, you know, frequently bring up controversial or difficult points, but always handled with a sense of lightness and humour to it. So this also is part of the Atthakavagga teachings. And what's one of the things that's interesting about them is that there's very little mention of things like sort of advanced states of meditation and so on. Certainly not saying that they aren't. They are actually mentioned in various places, but not emphasized as much as we're used to in the standard teachings like the Eightfold Path and the Threefold Training and so on. And we often find these things like, you know, if somebody is always mindful and not attached to things and always able to let go, then that's somebody who can truly be said to be at peace. Or you say that, like, if somebody's crossed over and is unattached and not dependent, then this is what's called a true Brahman, like a true enlightened one. And in these little verses, you know, giving very pithy summaries of the Dhamma, one thing, you know, it shows you that these Dhammas are not just shallow, they're not just preliminary Dhammas, they're actually very powerful and very profound things. Practicing of contentment, of letting go. It's not something which is very basic. These verses are always saying, if you can really do this, then that's what they call an arahant, is someone who's content and not attached to things. And that's essentially what these verses are saying. And if we didn't know the context, and if we didn't have the experience ourselves, we might think that, well, it's something that sounds so easy. It sounds so simple. Of course, in a sense, it is easy. It is simple. There's nothing hard about letting go. You just have to do it, that's all. And so there's really nothing else to it. There's nothing else to the spiritual life. There's nothing else. You know, this was always one of the things when I was a young monk, and as I said, I kept a copy of these suttas with me all the time, and recited them every day for years. And it's always been my wish, my vision in my monastic life, is to try to live as much as possible in accordance with these teachings. This is my ideal for monastic life, and this is what I experienced when I was in Thailand, staying at little hermitages like Phujomgom, where, you know, we were really able to live in that kind of quiet, harmonious and simple way. And these kind of conditions that I've tried my best to create here at Santi, and to provide for others to live as well. There's something perfect about it. Something timeless. And just having a kuti in the forest. That's just simple. There's nothing fancy, nothing. Just simple. And we just go there and just be. And just being content with that, being content with the seclusion, being content with the quiet, being content with each other, being content with our meditation, being content with the practices that we're doing, being content with the food that's offered, being content with the weather, just being content. And when we come back to our Buddhist practice, this is really all that matters. Everything else, honestly, is just fluffle. You know? The other day I got sent an email from Engkong. He sent some slideshow of this temple in China. And he said, "Oh, isn't this a beautiful temple?" And I looked at it and I thought, it's just... it's just... everything's glossy and glowing and decorated and fancy and pictures and decorations and... This is not Dhamma to me. It's got nothing to do with Dhamma. It's not what the Buddha was teaching. This is not... to me, that's not a temple. The temple is what you see around you here. It's the trees, it's the rocks, it's the air. That's the most beautiful temple. And the hard thing in building a monastery is not building beautiful salas or shrines or halls or anything like that. That's not hard. The hard thing is keeping it simple. The hard thing is really keeping it simple. The hard thing is just leaving it at that. Leaving it at those simple things that the Buddha taught again and again and again, and which are taught in the Attikavagga so beautifully, again and again and again. How can we be content to have our Buddhism and our practice be just that much? Is this enough for us to be working with, to be going on with? Do we have to be filling our lives with a whole lot of other things? Or can we just be content with just this much? So when I heard I mentioned in the class yesterday, I heard some years ago that there was one monk in Burma, don't know anything about him, but just somebody said that there was a Western monk in Burma who was convinced that only the Attikavagga was the Buddha's essential teachings, everything else was a later addition. Even though from a scholastic point of view I think that's a serious exaggeration. But still, I can empathize with that. I can think that I can understand that it seems that just those essential teachings is enough. You know, we can read them, and just in one verse or just a few verses, that's what we need to practice with. And so, monastic life is... it's a very different kind of thing than in kind of worldly careers where you have a certain curriculum, you master a certain body of information and certain skills that you're expected to master after X a number of years, and then you can go and do this and do that. And that's how, you know, they do things in secular education, and it's how Buddhist education has often tended to become. And you know, I kind of try to resist that to some degree. I mean, I do think it's good to have a good education in Buddhism, but I kind of resist the idea that it's about sort of, you know, mastering a particular body of knowledge. And for me, the process of education is a process of it's something which is much more constant, or more it's more cyclical. It's a constant expansion and drawing out of knowledge and understanding and appreciation of the Dhamma. It's not something where you sort of master a set body of knowledge and then you can move on to the next. And so monastic life always has that timeless quality to it. One day is pretty much the same as the next. One week is pretty much the same as the next. And yeah, we change some things, and the schedule changes sometimes, and people come and go, and the years change, and the weather changes, and we change inside ourselves. So this change is happening, but it's happening through that kind of almost like a wave, the kind of waves or the ripples on the water. And just sort of gently going through one day after the next. And getting a sense for a life that just is, rather than a life that's going somewhere. Rather than trying to, you know, think, you know, in 10 years' time I'll have achieved this, and then another 10 years I'll have achieved that, and then I'll be able to buy a house, and then I'll be able to reach this level in my company, and so on and so forth. But just thinking, it just is. Every day, just are. Just content for that much. Every day, the sun rises. Every day, you have something to eat. Every day, you do some chores. Every day, we do some meditation. Every day we do some chanting or study of the Dhamma. Every day, just like that. And so there's like a contentment of being with what's happening. Just being with it. And just learning to be with it, to be content. And that in itself is the training. That in itself is what we're here to do. We're here to learn the contentment of just being. So that's probably enough for this evening, so I offer that for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
The comment is here to say teaching on basically not attached views as a response to a certain behaviour which people go into rather than being a doctrinal of the self.
Right, yeah. Definitely, and I think you know, one of the things with the Atikavanga verses, they don't give us a context, unlike the prosuttas. So yeah, but you know, you can certainly it seems to me likely that was given in the context where they were probably, some of the monks were, you know, getting really enthusiastic about going out and refuting all the other ascetics and so on. So the Buddha's kind of saying, well, just chill out a bit. The Atikavaka does.
It does?
Yeah, the Atikavaka has a parallel in Chinese. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I don't know much about it, actually. I've seen it mentioned that it does have that parallel, and I think there's been some studies done on it, but I haven't actually studied in detail, so I'm not sure how close the parallels are. But there is a parallel anyway.
So the fact that it has parallel means that it's more likely to be.
That's one of the factors to be taken into consideration. Yeah. Yeah, but that, as we mentioned, there's also the themes, the topics, the language, the style, and all these kinds of things also. You know, everything taken together also points to the earliness of it. So if you don't make those kinds of judgments based on just one criteria, but based on a whole range of different criteria, and when they all agree and they all say that it's early, then that's when you can feel quite confident. Metta Sutta is also, as well as not having parallels, but it's also a later metrical style.